from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. Coming up in our second hour of Forum this morning, we're going to keep looking at election 2012. With the presidential election and the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy dominating the news, the battle over who will control Congress is receiving less attention. And yet the outcome of that struggle will have everything to do with how Washington works or doesn't work in the coming year. In the hour ahead, we'll assess which party is likely to control the House and the Senate and what that may mean for the big decisions facing Washington and the country in 2013. That's ahead on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. You may not be familiar with Tammy Baldwin, Shirley Berkeley, Elizabeth Warren, or John Tester, or Josh Mandel, Richard Murdoch, Rick Berg, or George Allen. But what happens to those collections of Democrats and Republicans next Tuesday will likely determine who controls the United States Senate. Right now, each party can count on winning 40-some Senate seats, but who knows what will happen after that? The picture in the House of Representatives, on the other hand, is more clear, with most signs pointing towards a continuation of Republican control. That means that depending on who wins the White House, Republicans could control all three branches of government. The Democrats probably at best two out of three. And so in this hour Forum, we focus on that other race, the battle for congressional control, and the enormous issues the next Congress will face regardless of who wins. Joining us to start out on that topic this morning, Marty Cady. He's congressional editor for Politico. Marty, good morning.
Good morning.
And Shira Tuplitz joins us as well. She is a political reporter for Roll Call. Shira Tuplitz, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Happy to have you both join us. Let's have you give us your overall picture first. Just give us a kind of quick snapshot as to what the likely prospects are in the Senate and the House. Marty Cady, as you look at that, do you think Democrats are likely to hold on to control of the Senate?
It's looking more and more like that. What's pretty remarkable right now is that after a two-year battle for the Senate, we might see almost no change in the numbers. Just this morning, we've seen a poll out of Indiana. You mentioned Richard Murdoch. Well, the poll we saw this morning has his opponent, Joe Donnelly, up 11 points.
Wow.
That would be a loss of a seat for Republicans. That was Dick Lugar's old seat. You know, Elizabeth Warren, you mentioned, she continues to lead. And down here in Virginia, where I live, Tim Kaine, the former governor, the Democrat, has had a pretty consistent but close lead over George Allen. So as of right now, Republicans are not surging, despite having a lot of opportunities to pick up a lot of seats. So as of right now, it's looking like the Democrats should hold on. Anything can happen in the next few days, but Democrats are looking better than we expected.
And Shira Tuplitz, do you agree with that assessment, that that's the way things look at the moment?
Yeah, absolutely. The House is not really in play. We expect Democrats to maybe pick up a handful of seats, maybe a little more than that. But Marty's depiction of what's going on in the Senate races is absolutely accurate. What Democrats have, to their credit, been effectively been able to do this cycle is to take a lot of races where Republicans thought there were gimmies. They thought for sure they were going to win races like Missouri, North Dakota, and Indiana, as he mentioned. And they've been able to play in these contests and really make it a fight.
Well, let's approach this a bit like how we will elect next Tuesday on election night and give our listeners a kind of what to look for on election night, a kind of viewer and listener guide to what will be taking place in these Senate battles on November the 6th. And let's do it as we will on election night, starting on the East Coast first. Some of the key Senate races we've already touched on, Virginia, Massachusetts, Indiana, Ohio, all in the Eastern time zone. So let's look at each one and what you'll be looking for in Virginia, where you are, Marty Cady. How soon will we know, likely, as to whether or not it's looking like a Tim Kaine or a George Allen kind of race?
I think we should know fairly early. I mean, Virginia tends to button up its ballots pretty early. If you recall, in 2008, when Virginia was called in, I think like the 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock hour for Obama. Correct me if I'm wrong. So if Tim Kaine wins that, remember, that's a Democratic hold. The current senator, Jim Webb, is retiring. But if Tim Kaine hangs on, it's looking like a pretty good night for Democrats, because we will also be watching the Massachusetts race. When those polls close on the East Coast, Elizabeth Warren is up by 5 or 6 points consistently. That'll be a Democratic pickup, because Scott Brown is a Republican senator, and those are races to watch. As you move over down in Florida, Senator Bill Nelson looks like he's comfortably ahead of Congressman Connie Mack. And then over in Ohio, that race has tightened a lot between Senator Sherrod Brown and Josh Mandel, but Brown has been consistently ahead. But if you're watching Ohio, everyone's watching Ohio for the presidential, and the interplay between the presidential coattails and the Senate race is important. So I'd be watching Ohio pretty late into the night.
And on the coattails question, Shiratopoulos, what is the history on that, whether or not top of the ticket tends to affect Senate races in some of these individual states? Do they go hand in hand?
It depends on the state. Marty mentioned Virginia. I think that's definitely the case there, definitely the case in Ohio. But that is not the case in a state like North Dakota or Indiana or Missouri, where Mitt Romney will almost surely carry those states, perhaps even by double digits, especially in North Dakota's case. But the Democrats are kind of waging their own battle. And that's an additional challenge for some of these candidates like Heidi Heitkamp, Claire McCaskill, Joe Donnelly. They have to run 10 to 15 points ahead of the president in their home state to win.
On Indiana, it's an interesting state. It's one Obama carried in 2008, clearly very, very unlikely to do so this year. And the senator who lost in the primary, Dick Lugar, was sort of one of the last bipartisan forces within the Senate. How much does that race depend on the Democrat, Joe Donnelly, sort of separating himself from Barack Obama, Shira, or is he able to be in place simply because of the difficulties with some of the things that Richard Murdoch has said?
Well, that's a really great question. I was just in Indiana a couple weeks ago doing a story on this race in particular. And what, as you mentioned, Richard Murdoch defeated Dick Lugar in the primary way back in May. And one of the effects of that primary for Richard Murdoch was it completely drained his cash supply. But it gave Joe Donnelly an advantage, especially early in the summer, to really define the race how he wanted to define it. And that's one of the only reasons, aside from his comment in the debate last week, that this race is in play. It's because Democrats could define the race on their term. And in this case, they chose to define Murdoch as a, quote, my way or the highway, unquote, kind of senator, someone who they used quotes from some of his post-primary interviews saying he doesn't believe in bipartisanship, that kind of thing. So Donnelly was really able to shape the race that way. And Murdoch, in response, both the candidate and his allies have tried to paint Joe Donnelly as kind of basically a token or a lackey of Nancy Pelosi or Barack Obama. The president is not held in very high regard in the state of Indiana, so that's been their most frequent line of attack against him. But a lot of these attacks came later, especially on the airways, because Murdoch, in many ways, is still recovering from the primary for such a long time. And you brought up Lugar, and it's so fascinating to me that many, many months after this primary, Lugar, in a way, still has a shadow over this race, because he had a lot of supporters, especially in the suburbs of Indianapolis and those collar counties there, who voted for him in the primary, and who were probably more moderate Republicans, maybe independents, and they are still on the fence. And that's what made Murdoch's comment in the debate last week.
We should repeat what that comment was. It had to do with saying that if a baby is conceived as a result of a rape, it's something that God intended.
Yes, exactly. And I was there for that comment, too. And the next day, people were talking about it in coffee shops, something that a lot of people heard about. And basically, this one of the reasons this comment was so devastating to Richard Murdoch's candidacy at this last minute was because you have a lot of voters, particularly women in these collar counties, who are probably still on the fence. You know, they're inclined to vote Republican usually, but they weren't sure about Richard Murdoch yet, and this gave them a reason not to vote for Richard Murdoch.
And Marty, Katie, while we're on this topic, let's bring in Missouri, because, of course, Todd Akin in Missouri got a lot of grief for his comment about the role of rape and legitimate rape and all the rest. Has that brought Claire McCaskill back to the forefront of being able to hold on to that seat for the Democrats?
Absolutely. I mean, you hate to identify any specific gaffe or moment as a true game changer, but that was an unbelievable moment in that campaign. I mean, Todd Akin was not the ideal pick for National Republicans, but he still looked like he was on his way to winning. If you track the history of those polls in Missouri from the spring and summer and then to when Akin made his comments, and remember, the entire National Republican establishment abandoned Akin. And Claire McCaskill has gone ahead. I mean, she was the number one target for Democrats. She was a perfect pickoff opportunity for Republicans. I'm sorry. A Democrat who is very connected to Barack Obama in a state that is tilting back to Republicans pretty hard. And now she's up by, maybe Sharon's seen the latest polls. She's up by half a dozen points. It could get close. I mean, these Senate polls swing wildly in the final days. But that was a classic moment of a guy, a senator, Senate candidate, said something that just blew up his candidacy.
Let's stay in the Central Time Zone for a moment and talk about Wisconsin. This is where the retiring senator is a Democrat, Herb Kohl. The race between the two candidates to take on that seat, Tammy Baldwin, a liberal Democrat from the state capital city of Madison, and Tommy Thompson, the longtime former, served as governor of Wisconsin for four terms. Wisconsin is another really curious state that can sort of tends to vote Democratic in presidential elections, Marty Katie, but its Senate representation can be, you know, quite all over the map. Where does that race stand as we look at it now?
Wisconsin is an incredible political state, and it has been for the past 2 years. I mean, this is a state where Russ Feingold was super popular. He was a Democratic senator. He voted against both wars, against the Patriot Act, a liberal icon. Scott Walker, a very conservative governor, it pushed through the anti-union legislation, survived a recall, and now Tommy Thompson is running as a popular former governor against someone who would be the first openly gay female senator, Tammy Baldwin. And she is one of the more liberal members of the House. And it's a toss-up. I mean, Wisconsin is sort of the center of the political universe. And both the presidential candidates have been there. And don't forget, it's Paul Ryan's home.
So right.
What a scattershoot of politics you have in Wisconsin, which is why it's hard to call this race. I mean, it's very close. I think Thompson is probably favored in this moment, but that's one you got to watch late into the night, because that would be a Republican pickup of a Democratic seat if Thompson wins.
And sure, Tubblitz, again on the coattails question there. That's a state, as I recall, that often does not have necessarily the coattail effect. But how will because that's going to be a very closely watched state, along with Ohio and a few others, in terms of the presidential election. What's the sense of how that may affect the Baldwin-Thompson race?
It is going to affect the Baldwin-Thompson race. I've talked to a reporter who covers this race closely for us yesterday about it. The consensus was that Baldwin is probably going to run a point or two behind Obama in the state. So, again, this is obviously just from the polls we've looked at, but if Obama wins by 5 points in that state, which is by no means a gimme, it's a highly competitive state, then Baldwin has a really good chance of keeping that seat for the Democrats. And obviously the reverse is true as well. If Romney wins that state, then Baldwin has very little chance at all of picking up maintaining the seat for her party.
Let's move a bit further west and talk about North Dakota, Montana, Nevada, but North Dakota and Montana, two Democratic seats that Republicans thought they might well be able to pick off. True, Marty Katie, where do those Senate races stand?
Yeah, both of these races are ones the Republicans thought they should pick off. And in North Dakota, we have a retiring senator, Ken Conrad. At this point, the Republican Congressman Rick Berg has the advantage. It's a slight advantage over the Democrat Heidi Heitkamp. Heitkamp has run a very solid race. She's a statewide official. She's run a very good sort of retail, you know, door-to-door North Dakota campaign. But Rick Berg, one of the advantages of these congressmen in sparsely populated states is that he's already been elected statewide, right? So, and he seems to have the advantage there. That would probably be a Republican pickup. Montana is the race to watch, I think. Having watched and covered the 2006 version of this, when Senator John Tester won, They were counting those ballots for a week. Remember, he beat the Republican Senator Conrad Burns back in 2006. That race helped tip the Senate to the Democrats in 2006. It's a very sparsely populated state. It might take them a while to count the ballots, and is literally tied. Tester is running against Congressman Danny Rehberg. I would be afraid to call that race because it's so close and there's so few votes out in that state in the first place.
Marty Cady, I know you have to leave us, but thanks so much for adding your sense of all of these races to our program this morning. We're also joined now by Jack Pitney, who is a professor of government at Claremont McKenna College. Jack Pitney, good morning.
Thank you.
And Larry Gersten joins us as well, professor of political science at San Jose State University, author of Not So Golden, After All, The Rise and Fall of California. Larry Gersten, good morning, too.
Good morning to you.
So let's fold out our conversation a bit, and then we'll also come back down and drill more deeply into some of the congressional races here in California. But Jack Pitney, as you've been listening to this conversation, I'm curious about your view as to what you think the Senate may be like as an institution after this next election, if it indeed does stay in Democratic control. Will it be more partisan than ever? Will some of these races bring a more moderate tone? How do you look at sort of what the sort of sense and feel of the Senate may be like after November the 6th?
It will continue to be partisan because of the filibuster. Whichever party is nominally in control, the other party is going to be able to stop just about anything. And that's going to mean trouble either for President Obama or a President Romney. And that's been the pattern in this Congress and doesn't look to change very much in the next.
And how would it change, Jack Pitney, if Republicans are able to buck this trend and gain control? And if there is a President Romney and Republicans maintain control of the Congress, does that change everything? I mean, that then you would have the Republicans in control of all three branches.
Well, again, the key word is nominal.
Yeah.
If Republicans take control of the Senate, it's going to be by the narrowest of margins, maybe 50 or 51 votes. And in a situation like that, Democrats will be able to filibuster in some cases on some roll calls, be able to defeat Republicans outright. Where it does make a difference will be in judicial nominations,
yep.
Because the next president will have some Supreme Court nominations, and that would improve the chances for a President Romney to get his nominees confirmed.
Do you concur, Larry Gersten, that in an odd way, as Jack Pitney is describing it, except for the case of judicial nominations, that who controls the Senate because of the filibuster rule in the end may not matter that much?
Mostly, yes. There is this power that exists in the Senate called reconciliation, which both sides tend to use very gingerly. And the question for me would be whether, if Republicans control all three branches, whether they might be tempted to use it to get some of the policies of the Obama administration reversed. But and it's also a psychological momentum of sorts for the Republicans. If they can get control of all three, that's got to be a boost psychologically for them, and might lead them to be rather rambunctious.
Sure, Tubbs, take us through how those sorts of bigger questions about the way in which the Senate functions as an institution, whether or not there can be a more meeting of minds, or this question of how it will affect judicial nominations. Are those things playing out in individual Senate races? How are those campaigns actually being waged?
Wow. Go ahead, sorry.
Sure, go ahead first, and then I'll come to the others on that. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great question, because what you're seeing in a lot of these races is something we haven't seen for a couple cycles now. We've had these wave elections and, frankly, very partisan elections. You see candidates talking to their bases a lot more than they talk to independent voters, and we've seen that echoed to a certain degree on the presidential race, at least recently. But in a couple select races this time around, we are seeing candidates touting their bipartisanship and wanting to work with the other side. There used to be a weekly luncheon between Senator Joe Manchin and Senator Mark Kirk in the Senate, and they were kind of their own little bipartisan lunch, and it was symbolic for a long
Illinois
time.
Illinois and West Virginia, is that
exactly.
right?
Exactly, yeah. And unfortunately Mark Kirk suffered a stroke about a year ago, so the lunches are not going on right now. He's recovering from that, but, when they were happening, they used to be a symbol of just how little bipartisanship there was left in the Senate. You basically have two guys, a Dem representing a sort of reddish-pinkish state and a Republican representing a blue state meeting together. And it really depends who gets elected this time around, who might join that crowd. You look at a race like Arizona, for example. And Jeff, and it's a competitive race, although the Republican Jeff Flake probably has an advantage there in the end. And he's a guy who's a who's known as anti-earmark. He's been supported by the Club for Growth, which is a very conservative, anti-pork barrel spending organization, very fiscally conservative. And if he comes to the Senate, he will be aligned with Senator Jim DeMint, and they will be very conservative people, and probably not, less willing to compromise, I think, on certain issues, especially related to fiscal matters. But you know, you have some Democrats in particular running in these red states who have run on their bipartisan credentials, which is unusual, as I said, compared to previous cycles where you really had a lot of candidates running running for their bases.
Larry Gersten, then back to you, Jack Pitney, on this question of the prospects for bipartisanship, because this next Congress, unless it happens in the lame duck session, will have to deal with certain issues, sequestration and all of that. Do you see a way out or a way in for bipartisanship to come back to the forefront? Larry Gersten first.
Sequestration is the last thing that would be good. So the question then becomes, how do you get yourself out of it? If Obama wins re-election, it would seem to me there'd be more pressure to act sooner. Okay, we're stuck with him for the next 4 years, Republicans would say, and Democrats likewise would say, let's deal. If Romney wins, he's going to need some time. Because sequestration is tied into so many other things, including his budget. So the likelihood is he'd ask Congress to keep everything in place, keep the tax cuts in place. And if he has his majorities, they would no doubt go along with it. So I think we're going to see a different kind of play depending upon who wins.
Jack Pitney.
They're both dealing with the same arithmetic. The deficit is bad, and in the long term, demographics are going to make it worse. So even though prospects for a grand compromise might seem hazy, eventually there's going to be there'll have to be some kind of compromise because the arithmetic demands it.
Do you see Jack Pitney, someone, you know, we talked earlier about the end of Richard Lugar's career, who's been in was in the Senate for almost 40 years, I think. Is that right? I mean, a long, long time.
36.
Yeah. And is there, I mean, is he the last of a breed, or do you see someone, Jack Pitney, who will sort of carry that torch forward?
It's hard to say. It just depends on who ends up winning. In Wisconsin, Tommy Thompson is running as a bipartisan problem solver. He's a conservative Republican, but he's been able to work with Democrats on issues such as welfare reform. On the Democratic side, if Bob Kerrey unexpectedly wins in Nebraska, he was also able to work with Republicans on a variety of issues, including terrorism. So that's the nature of the Senate. A lot of this depends much more than in the House on the individuals.
And whether or not there will be a new gang of 6 or 13 or whatever it happens to be to contend with all these questions. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk more about what the prospects are for some of these individual races. And we're also going to dig into some of the congressional races in California, some interesting contests, both where either Democrats or Republicans could make gains, and also some Democrat versus Democrat races because of the state's new top two system of electing candidates. We'll talk about all of that when we return. We'd like to have you join us as well. What are your questions about what to look towards on election night? What are some of the races that you're most interested in hearing more about? You can join us at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your question on our Facebook page or on our website. Back with more in just a moment. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, an election guide, a preview of what to look for on election night, not so much on the presidential front, but on the battle for control of Congress, both within the House of Representatives and the United States Senate. What are the key races we should be paying attention to? How will that affect the kind of work that will come out of Washington, if work will come out of Washington at all, in the year 2013? Joining us, Shira Tuplett. She is the political reporter for Roll Call. Jack Pitney, professor of government at Claremont McKenna College in Claremont. Vermont, and Larry Gersten, professor of political science at San Jose State University. We welcome your calls on this subject as well, 866-733-6786. Any race in America that you have a question about, we probably have someone on board who could provide an answer to it. You can email us at forum@kqed.org or post your thoughts or questions on our Facebook page as well. Email from Paul, who writes in, is there any chance that the filibuster rule will be radically changed this session? Harry Reid has suggested that he will make such changes, and after such extreme use, or some would say abuse, of the filibuster rule by Republicans over the last 6 years, would they be willing to modify it if they win the Senate? This is one of these questions, Jack Pitney, where, you know, you get people arguing exactly the opposite of what they previously argued, depending on who it is who has control of the Senate, because certainly Democrats have used the filibuster rule to their advantage as well. Any change that might take place in the coming term?
Very unlikely. This has been batted back and forth for a number of years, and the minority party in the Senate just has too much leverage in order for such a thing to go forward. So it's not very likely that we're going to see any change in the filibuster rule until we see at some future election a really massive shift in the composition of the Senate.
Larry Gersten, how do you see that?
I think that's exactly right. The last time this rule was changed was in the 60s when the Democrats did have a massive majority, and they changed it from 2/3 to 60 votes. And it took forever to do that. And you don't see those kinds of lopsided results in the Senate very often. So it's going to stay the way it is, especially right now, given the relative balance between the two parties.
Sure, Tuplis, is anyone making the argument, and I'm sure there are candidates making the argument, that they're going to go to Washington to set a different tone? You were alluding to some people sort of saying they're willing to cross the aisle. Is that a winning argument these days, or are we so polarized that sort of approach is the kiss of death rather than being something that makes people inclined to vote for you?
It depends on the state completely. Let's look at Massachusetts, for example. Senator Scott Brown ran in that special election for the late
right.
Senator Ted Kennedy seat on a mantle of change. He wanted to change this, and also the health care legislation was pending before the Senate at the same time, and that had a lot to do with it, too. And this time around, he's definitely trying to tout his bipartisan credentials and what has become an uphill battle for him to keep his seat. So it does happen. I was also in Ohio recently with Senator Sherrod Brown and his opponent, State Treasurer Josh Mandel. And Mandel, in particular, is really stressing the change issue in his his election campaign. He's saying Sherrod Brown has been in Washington for over 20 years, and he's been running for office since Richard Nixon was in office. He kept saying that over and over again on the campaign trail. So that's something he's pushing in particular. But like I said, it depends on the state, the candidate, the incumbent. And we mentioned Indiana again when Richard Murdoch was challenging Dick Lugar. That was something he said constantly because Dick Lugar had been in office for 36 years.
Sure, Tuplis, political reporter for Roll Call. I guess what I'm curious at trying to get at is there seems to be, Jack Pitney, such cynicism about government these days and such a feeling that Washington doesn't work and frustrations that things are so partisan. And yet that sort of functions out there in the third person, because when it comes time to vote for your particular candidate, then partisanship begins to sway once more. What are your thoughts about whether or not we can get to a point where we're able to actually make some choices, as opposed to just being seemingly stuck forever in neutral?
Yeah, the irony of this election, if today's polls are any indication of what's going to happen, is that the composition of the government is pretty much going to be the same after the election as it was before. So at a time when people are extremely dissatisfied with the government, with the way the government is working, they vote for
same
government. Eventually, on some of the issues, the fiscal issues, again, the simple arithmetic of the deficit is going to force some kind of decision. There's going to be some kind of compromise. Republicans are going to have to give some kind of ground on revenues, whether they call it a tax increase or disguise it in some way. The only question is how far along the road do we get before we reach that point?
Does anyone see, Larry Gerson, maybe you on this first, someone out there who's going to be that bold soul, a bold Republican who is going to say, you know what, we do in fact need to raise extra revenue? Or on the other hand, a bold Democrat who's going to say, yes, indeed, we really do have to focus on fixing some of our entitlement expenditures. See anybody out there carrying that torch?
I think for the Democrats, it's going to have to be the president if he's reelected. He's in the best position. He doesn't have to worry about another term. It's a time to let it all out. For the Republicans, I would think it would be in the Senate. Mitch McConnell has worked with the Democrats much more consistently over the years. And Boehner, of course, in the House finds himself hemmed in a bit from his Tea Party colleagues who have been able to be very successful in keeping much of their agenda in place. So I would tend to think that the Senate would be the grown-ups on this deal.
Sure. Tuplis, how do you see that? Is there a bipartisan John Boehner lurking in there somewhere if only he could escape his Tea Party caucus?
Maybe, but the problem is you don't need one. You need about eight. Because the filibuster rules in the Senate, you need 60 votes to get something done either way. So it's really hard to see. I mean, there are a couple members who could. Joe Manchin from West Virginia is almost surely going to win re-election this cycle. He's one that's been known to cross party lines. Again, Mark Kirk, I mentioned earlier, who is currently out of the Senate for health problems. But he's a fiscal conservative.
Barack Obama's old seat, right?
Yeah, it is Barack Obama's old seat. Exactly correct. And he won it in 2010 by a slim, slim margin. And as he comes back, he is known for working across the aisle as well. But he's a fiscal conservative. It's hard to see him proposing revenue generators or anything along those lines. And again, like I said, you need more than one.
Sure, Tuplis from Roll Call, joining us this hour, along with Jack Pitney from Claremont McKenna College, Larry Gerson, San Jose State University. We welcome your participation at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your questions on our Facebook page or on our website. Let's talk a little bit about some of these interesting congressional races in California, even though it looks like the prospects for who controls the House of Representatives is unlikely to change, that it will likely continue to be a Republican-controlled House. There are some really interesting races in California. And let's start with a couple where there are Democrats versus Democrats because of our new top two rule. And maybe start us out, Larry Gerson, here in the Bay Area, where you have this intriguing race between Pete Stark, who's been in Congress forever, and Eric Swalwell.
That's my favorite race in Northern California. There's no question about it. It's the confluence of two changes. The top two primary system, which allows two people from whatever party or no party to run, whoever receives the most votes, the two most vote getters in the June. And then, of course, we had reapportionment through the Citizens Independent Commission. And that's led to a real makeover in the district now represented by Pete Stark. Half of it's new. And, of course, Stark has exhibited some behavior that some would consider to be a bit questionable. You've got a new guy coming in, Eric Swalwell. It has the makings of an upset, even though the Democratic establishment has lined up behind Stark.
And even though it's going to stay Democratic regardless. There's one of those in Southern California as well, right, Jack Pitney, between Howard Berman and Brad Sherman, two Democrats. And that's been a pretty contentious battle.
Oh, yes. And what makes the battle so contentious is that the issue differences between them are so small. Their voting records are essentially identical. To a large extent in the past, they've been allies, but redistricting put them in the same seats. And neither one of them wanted to move out, so that they've been battling on mostly personal issues. And it's taken some bizarre turns. At a town hall a couple of weeks ago, it almost physically broke out into a fight where Sherman grabbed Berman. And that was caught on YouTube and went viral. And most recently, a very strange development, a super PAC supporting Sherman put out a mailer tying Howard Berman to, get this, Barbara Boxer. The appeal, obviously, it was intended to appeal to Republican voters, but it's very strange when one California Democrat accuses another of having ties to the Democratic senator.
Let's talk a little about Democrats who may be endangered and Republicans who may be endangered within the House of Representatives. Jerry McNerney, Larry Gersten, this is always a tight seat. What's likely going on there?
He'll be challenged. There's no question about it. In an irony, he has more Democrats in his district this time around than any of the other three elections. So for that reason, he may find himself in a little bit better shape than one would have expected. On the other hand, his challenger, Ricky Gill, a young guy, with bringing in a lot of money from the Indian American communities, actually outraised McNerney. So there's no shortage of funds here. McNerney will play in the incumbency and a slightly different Democratic district.
And what about John Garamendi? That's another seat that's been largely reconfigured. Is he in any trouble?
Well, Garamendi, his problem is that he's so new to that district. He was just elected a couple of years back in a special election, and the district was changed on him after that. So he's had an awful lot of work to do in an increasingly agricultural district. There's no question about it. He's opposed by a Republican county supervisor who also has been able to raise money, although not as much as Garamendi. So these will be good races. It would seem to me that Garamendi McNerney will win. I think there are others that might be in more jeopardy, particularly a Republican could be in jeopardy, Dan Lundgren, perhaps. But other than that, I think we won't see many surprises.
And in Southern California, Jack Pitney, I'm curious about what's going on with two races in particular. Jeff Denham's race against Jose Hernandez and Mary Bono Mack's race against Raul Ruiz.
Those are target races. Both of them are potentially losses for the Republicans. Jeff Denham hasn't been in Congress very long and has a newly configured district, so that's a problem for him. In the Bono Mack Ruiz race, you've had some very high profile opposition research. A very difficult race for her. And Mary Bono Mack's opposition research discovered that when he was at Harvard Medical School, Ruiz made a speech in favor of Leonard Peltier, who is in prison for killing an FBI agent, and he made this at a rally against Thanksgiving. So this is a speech that could cost Ruiz some critical votes in a race that might otherwise tilt Democratic.
Ruiz and Hernandez, both Latino candidates. And Sherrod Tuples, an interesting bit of information I gleaned from an article I read yesterday has to do with the demographics of who's in the House of Representatives. And the point was that the House Democrats come 2013, that the majority of the Democratic caucus will be women and people of color, that white men will be a minority within the Democratic caucus, and that in the Republican side is the exact opposite, that 85% to 90% will be white men. What do you make of that and how Congress may function, I guess, going forward?
Well, I think it's unique. I'm sure Democrats will use it as a point of pride, saying they're the more diverse party. I think we'll be able to see that in a lot of probably their materials they'll put out over the next year. But it's more interesting to take a long-term view at where these numbers are headed. And you mentioned the Hispanic candidates. I can't emphasize enough how much Hispanic votes, especially in a lot of these traditionally Republican states, are going to matter in the next couple of years. Beyond California, you look at the
demographics. Is that what's changing Arizona?
Changing Arizona, exactly. That Arizona gained population over the last 10 years. They picked up a new congressional seat because of it. And a Republican stand to maybe lose a seat or hold even in what is known as a traditionally Republican state because of the changing Hispanic demographics. But go beyond that. We can go to Texas in 10 years. There's a lot of people, a lot of demographic experts believe Texas could be in play in a decade or 15 years because of the Hispanic vote. But obviously it depends 15 years from now how Hispanics vote, if they're monolithic or not, or if they're more diverse. And then Georgia, too. Georgia's another state that's increasing, and the minority populations in Georgia could put that seat in play in 10 to 15 years.
What do you each see as being kind of front and center on the congressional agenda come January with whoever has control of the two houses of Congress? So much sort of has been stalled in recent years, and I'm curious to hear what you think will Congress will have to contend with, or will we just stay stalled? Start us out, Jack Pitney.
I think the three top issues are going to be deficit, deficit, and deficit. The economy is going to overwhelm everything, although this is one case where the identity of the presidential winner will make a difference. If Romney is elected, he's going to make some effort to scale back the health care bill, and the question is how is he going to try to do it, and what form is that legislation going to take? If the president wins, of course, will want to keep it in place. But whoever wins, deficit politics is going to overwhelm just about everything else.
Larry Gerson, you see it the same way?
Definitely. But I think along with, of course, controlling the deficit is key. But that raises the second issue, which absolutely has to be related. And that is, where are we going to cut? Where are we going to raise taxes? That all has to be part of what's been referred to before as the grand bargain. And that's when you get into those weeds, that's where it becomes difficult, because Republicans don't want to raise taxes. Democrats don't want to cut entitlements. And I think each has to realize, and I think they do individually, it's just collectively where they fall apart, that they have to make that kind of grand compromise sooner than later, because sooner is quickly running out of time.
Sure. Tablas, I'm curious about whether or not you see anyone providing leadership on those questions. Jack and Larry talked about that a little bit earlier. But is there a sort of, I'm going to tell you the truth person who if for example, a Claire McCaskill wins re-election, or a Tim Kaine, given that he's a former governor and former chair of the party, is there someone who will assume a new prominence on the Democratic side first, and then we can talk about Republicans in sort of confronting those core issues?
In confronting them, right now the first Democrat that comes to mind is Kent Conrad, who is retiring
right.
with his seat in North Dakota that's coming up. He's really been at the forefront of trying to deal with a lot of like the reforming the corporate tax rate, tax issues, budget issues, and as I meant, like I said, he's leaving pretty soon. If it's looking less and less likely. But if Democrats were to lose control of the Senate, I think we'd see a shift of power along the top. But, it's increasingly less likely. Could happen 2 years from now in that cycle, too. And then you'd see a shift of power between Harry Reid, potentially Dick Durbin, who's up for re-election in 2014, and Chuck Schumer, too. So you could see a different leadership, and that could really change the entire way the Senate operates in some ways, at least on the what would then be the minority side if that were to happen.
And what about on the Republican side in terms of leadership? Mitch McConnell, one of you was indicating earlier, has a history of being able to work some cross aisle, though he has also famously said his number one priority was to defeat Barack Obama. So will the Republican leadership stay the same if they remain the minority party, Larry Gerson?
It's always hard to tell, depending upon how many seats the Democrats pick up. Will the Republicans get restless and want to replace McConnell? That's a possibility. If the Democrats do much better than people anticipated, and I think at the beginning of the year, most of us thought that the Republicans were going to ascend to the majority. So I don't know to what extent that will be a political cost. If it is and you get new leadership, then all bets are off and you start at square one.
Jack Pitney, how do you see that?
Yeah, I think there's always a possibility after an unexpected loss, but I think in the case of the Senate, perception is going to be that if the Republicans fall short or even lose a seat or two on net, that reflects the peculiarity of individual races rather than any decision that happened in Washington, D.C. For instance, the Missouri race, which came up before, that had nothing to do with Mitch McConnell. That had to do with the winner in the Missouri primary. So I'd still bet on McConnell being the leader.
And what about on the Democratic side in the House, Shiratopoulos? Is, you know, there was some rumbling after the last election in 2010 about whether or not Nancy Pelosi would remain on as the Democratic leader in the House. Obviously, a topic of huge interest here in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Right.
Any rumblings within the Democratic ranks?
Well, there's talk about her postponing House Democrats postponing the election for their leader a couple weeks. So that to us, when that talk started to bubble up, that, you know, maybe Leader Pelosi was rethinking, just wanted more time to consider her decision, whether or not she'd want to step down or stay in leadership. So it showed a little hesitance on their part. Here's what I can say for sure, though. House Democrats were so bullish this entire cycle that they could win back the majority. They just had it 2 years ago. They were so publicly bullish about it. And the reality is, because we see the polls, we see how the map is looking 5 days beforehand, that's not going to happen. It's totally not possible. And there are going to be some members who are upset about that and want a new face of leadership in the party. Already 2 years ago, Pelosi had some dissidents who didn't vote for her for leader. If she does run again, you'll see probably an even bigger crew who don't vote for her for leader. But will it be enough to actually contest, or will it be enough for her to rethink her decision to run? We don't know yet. We'll see.
And who might step forward? I mean, some of those who challenged Democratic leadership, like Heath Shuler, are also stepping away, right, Shira? So who might be wanting to push past not only Nancy Pelosi, but Steny Hoyer?
Right. So that's, we'll see. I think if you're a Democrat right now, you don't talk about that right now. You want to put your name out there like that. You don't want a target on your back, especially before the election. You mentioned Steny Hoyer, though. Steny Hoyer and Nancy Pelosi have never had the best relationship, let's say. So, I mean, Steny Hoyer would obviously be eyeing that, and he's a very different kind of member than Congresswoman Pelosi or Leader Pelosi. So he could go for it, and then you could see someone else, probably from the more moderate wing of the Democratic Party, step up. Not someone like not Heath Shuler, because as you mentioned, he's retiring, but someone like Heath Shuler from that wing who could run.
Some emailed and Facebook questions coming in. April writes on our Facebook page, what about California's 14th congressional district? It looks like that could go to the Republicans, though it's been a Democratic seat for a while. And I will confess, I'm not sure about which district is the 14th. Larry, Jack, either of you help out on that? Shira?
We're talking the 14th. That's Jackie Spears' district, I believe. If that's the one we're talking about, I don't see any issues here whatsoever.
Right, right. No, I wouldn't think that Jackie Spear, if that's the 14th.
No, the challenge.
We rate all of the competitive races across House races in the country, and right now she's not on that race. Isn't on the list of leans Dem, likely Dem, so it must be a safe Dem.
Okay. And here's another email from someone who writes in, forgive me for what's perhaps a naive question, but why didn't the president try to pass legislation to raise taxes on the rich when the Democrats controlled both houses for the first 2 years of his presidency? Shira, why don't you take that? There's lots of questions about why, when he had everything, didn't get done.
Well, that is a great question. First, politically, the president spent so much capital on the health care bill and a lot of Democrats walked the plank for him on that. And after that, so many people in his party were hesitant to go towards anything else. I know a lot of people, especially in the organized labor community, thought they'd see some reforms there after health care, and obviously that never came up. And then the other time that it really was possible for the president was during the lame duck session following the last Congress, when Democrats still had majorities. The Senate, the numbers dwindled a little there because you had a couple of senators get seated early, but still Democrats held both chambers there. And then the president compromised. If you ask Democrats, they'll say he caved on raising taxes.
Jack Pitney, where do you see those prospects moving forward for a more energized, I guess you would say, White House? Some people have said that the president seems like he's sort of intellectually worn out. He's obviously not going to have both houses of Congress. Do you see a particular issue that he can kind of galvanize some support for and actually get something through Congress?
I think, again, not to be a broken record, but it keeps coming back to the deficit. And as Larry pointed out, that involves the tricky combination of spending cuts and tax increases. That's really arithmetic, the only way you can do it. The trouble is the history of second-term presidents has not been a happy one. In the case of President Bush, you had the war in Iraq going south and the financial meltdown. Bill Clinton, you had the impeachment. So part of this is why a lot of Republicans in the House may secretly not be too disappointed if Barack Obama wins re-election, because they would stand to pick up seats in the next midterm, whereas they would lose seats under a President Romney.
One last emailed question is about unhappiness with the top two. I'm curious to get your reaction to this, Larry Gerson. This person is writing from Marin County, where this person says, we're facing a choice between two Democrats for one state representative, in this case, Michael Allen, the party's choice, and a local San Rafael challenger. Michael Levine goes on to talk about frustration with this and concludes by saying, I'm tempted to vote against the Democratic Party on this because I'm so offended that our district is being used in this way because it's been such a difficult and negative campaign. You sense any reaction to how top two is beginning to play out?
I think people are just starting to realize it is not what they thought. They thought it would bring about moderation. It has in a couple of cases, but there's certainly no trend statewide. It has, on the other hand, disfranchised the second party. Minor parties have been disfranchised as well. And, yeah, you have in that district, for example, you have two Democrats. Where's the Republican? Where's the chance to elect a Republican? There is no chance. That the whole top two thing was tried a version of it about 15 years ago, and it didn't work very well then either.
It's funny, these unintended consequences. This is like ranked choice voting as well as another that's played out in ways that I don't think people expected. Just have a moment left, a quick 10 seconds each on what you're most going to be keeping an eye on besides, of course, the presidential race on November the 6th. Jack Pitney?
Early in the evening, keep an eye on Massachusetts. If Scott Brown wins, good night for Republicans. If Elizabeth Warren wins big, good night for Democrats.
Okay. Larry Gerson.
I want to see how many seats the Democrats pick off in the House, because I think they will pick off some. Not enough, but they're going to make it a lot more difficult for Republicans.
And Shira Tuplitz.
Yeah, I'll be watching Senate-wise Massachusetts, Ohio, and North Dakota, because those will be indicators of just how well Democrats or Republicans are doing that night. And then on the House side, there's a really competitive race near my hometown of Pittsburgh. It's Pennsylvania's 12th district. It's a conservative Democrat running in a really Republican district. I'll be watching that. I think that'll be indicative, too, of how things are going in the House.
Shira Tuplitz, Roll Call Magazine. We're also putting a link to the study she referenced about the congressional races on our website. Shira, thanks so much for being part of us.
Thank you.
And Jack Pitney, thanks to you from Claremont McKenna College. Larry Gerson, thanks to you as well from San Jose University. Pleasure to have both of you on our program today. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.